I desperately want to preach this sermon this morning. How's that? I don't know how if you desperately want to hear it or not, but I desperately want to preach it. We are working our way through the book of Galatians. We are right now in a little two-part series, the second of a two-part series that's out of Galatians 3, 4, and 5. This sounds extremely self-serving. I don't mean it that way, but if you were not here last week, the logic on this and the progression, I really would ask you to get a tape of last week's sermon. You can get information center. You can go up to the main information center and request a tape. It's how I clothe my children through the hard winter. No, I'm joking. I'm joking. I get nothing off the tapes. But anyhow, in fact, I've been known to burn the tapes. But anyhow, that's another story. I would encourage you to get a tape of that if you've not. At least you didn't hear it last week. I mean that way. This part two builds on that. Let's go through a sort of a crash course, if you don't mind, on what the book of Galatians is all about. There'll be some hard work. Stay with me here at the first. It's hard work as we lay the foundation. But I promise you that the application that comes out of this will be more than enough to cause every one of us to take a deep breath. The application out of the text is powerful. But let's do the hard work to get there. We start in Galatians chapter 1 saying, okay, what's this book about? And it sort of goes like this. In Galatians chapter 1, verse 6, Paul says, I am astonished that you are so quickly deserting the one who called you by the grace of Christ and are turning to a different gospel, which is really no gospel at all. Evidently, some people are throwing you into confusion and trying to pervert the gospel of Christ. But even if we or an angel from heaven should preach a gospel other than the one we preach to you, let him be eternally condemned. That's pretty strong language. But in case you didn't get it, he says, as we have already said, so now I say again. If anyone is preaching to you a gospel other than the one you've already accepted, let him... And the actual concept is, go to hell. That's what he's talking about. This is not a polite book from a polite little guy wanting to talk about trivial subject things. He's going, this matters. People are trying to steal the gospel of God and substitute it. Don't let them. Now, what are they doing? Well, chapter 2, verse 4 begins to give you a clue. Now, it doesn't tell you everything, but gets you a start. In chapter 2, verse 4, he says, but some false brothers had infiltrated our rank to spy on the freedom we have in Christ Jesus and to make us slaves. Now, I don't know what that's all about yet, but now I've got to the crux of the matter, at least at the starting point. Somebody is trying to steal our liberty in Christ and make us slaves. What's that mean? He will come a little further in chapter 2, verse 16, and he will say this, know that a man is not justified by observing the law, but by faith in Jesus Christ. So we too have put our faith in Christ Jesus, that we may be justified by faith in Christ and not by observing law, because by observing law, no one will be justified. Now again, this is not comic book stuff where you just sort of breeze through it and go, oh, I got the punchline and let's go on. No, this is pretty deep stuff, but his point is this. No man will ever be righteous in the sight of God, and no man will ever find power or life in rule-keeping and law-keeping. It is only in this thing called faith in Christ. Now, in case somebody doesn't know what faith in Christ is, he comes a little further. Verse 20, he uses himself as an illustration. I have been crucified with Christ, and I no longer live, but Christ lives in me. And the life I live in the body, I live by faith in the Son of God who loved me and gave himself for me. I do not set aside or disregard the grace of God. For if righteousness could be gained through law, then Christ died needlessly. Chapter 3, verse 10. All who rely on observing the law are under a curse. You'll be cursed. You will go to hell. If you try to be a law keeper in any way, gain something in the sight of God, it won't work. And you're still going, I don't know what all this law stuff means. We'll get to that. Chapter 3, verse 26. He uses a little different concept. He said, you are all sons of God through faith in Christ Jesus. Law keepers aren't sons. those who have faith are sons. And then in chapter 5, verse 1, which was read for you earlier, but I wanted to mention just a couple of verses. Chapter 5, verse 1, it is for freedom that Christ has set us free. Stand firm then and do not let yourself be burdened by a yoke of slavery. Chapter 5, verse 6, for in Christ Jesus neither circumcision nor uncircumcision. You're going, what in the world is this? He uses the phrase circumcision and uncircumcision. He uses those as just summary words of all the law that people were trying to teach. He just uses those as just kind of to wrap it all up. He says, neither one amount to anything, nor does any of the law amount to anything. The only thing that counts is faith expressing itself through love. Let's start. The faith of Jesus, the gospel of Jesus Christ is free of laws. Let me say it again. It is free of laws. This will be a hard thing for some to hear this morning. Some will resent what I have to say this morning. Some will resist it. Some will hear what I have to say this morning and say, that's not spiritual. That's not godly. What he's saying sounds liberal this morning. For some, I will be trying to tear down the very structures that you have used for your spiritual comfort and security. I will try to attack your Tower of Babel, if you know your Old Testament history. I will try to tear down what is comfortable and seems right to you. It has to come down. It is a lie. It is a lie. And it has hurt you long enough. It has to come down. For others, they're at the other end of the spectrum. When you hear what we're going to talk about this morning in the text, and when you hear that the gospel of Jesus Christ is free of laws, there'll be people who misuse that truth. There'll be people who will take off even harder on the road to hell and say to themselves, the preacher said I could. When you hear there is no law and you're free from law, some will say, good. And you'll use that freedom as a narcissistic license. It's a couple of fancy words I paid a lot of tuition for one day in a class. Basically, it means this. You'll use your own selfish heart to hang yourself. Paul is concerned about both of those groups. Those who are law keepers and law writers and law followers. He's also concerned about those who say, because there is no law, I can do what my heart desires, and my heart desires the dirt. He writes about those in the Galatians, and he writes to them. He writes in the book of Romans, and he writes to the Colossians. But while some may choose to misunderstand what Paul has to say, and some may choose to handle it differently, Paul says, I still am going to preach only the gospel. I'm not varying it. I'm not going to alter it because someone might misunderstand it. I am preaching the gospel. If somebody else misuses it, that's their problem. He said it's the gospel that's still marvelous and transforming and saving and true that is the gospel of Jesus Christ. For that's the gospel that will set you free. We're not going to go with something else. The central truth I used last week is that the Christian life, and the Christian is the sheep in the Lord's pasture. Not because fences hold him in the pasture, but because he hears his shepherd's voice and he follows. And so in a sense, those who are Christians are in the whole Christian circle, not because peer pressures holds them here. Not because the fences hold them here. Not because they're unfamiliar with any other lifestyle or pasture. Not because my wife makes me do so. Not because I'm afraid to be somewhere else. But I am a Christian and I need no other fences. I follow Christ. No other fences are needed. Paul in the book of Galatians uses the idea of a heart exchange. He actually uses an illustration that fits better for our culture. Heart transplant. In Galatians chapter 2, verse 20, let's look at that verse again. He says, I have been crucified with Christ and I no longer live. But Christ lives in me. And the life I live in the body, I live by faith in the Son of God who loved me and gave himself for me. The central concept is my heart died. I put to death my old heart. I came and I laid it before Christ and said, it needs to be crucified. It needs to die. And you put your heart in me. And Paul says, I am Christ and not mine. Paul says, I don't want my life. I don't want my agenda. I don't want my sin. I don't want my pride. I don't want my blindness. I don't want anything of mine. The only thing I want is for Christ to be lived out in me. In chapter 3, verse 27. Now, again, we're still just doing the hard part. Stay with me. In chapter 3, verse 27, he switches illustration slightly. He says, for all of you who are baptized into Christ have clothed yourself with Christ. And on this one, he uses the idea of clothed with Christ as opposed to the heart. But what he means is, I don't want to wear anything that's mine. I don't want to have anything that looks like mine. The only thing I want covering me is Christ. When people see me, when I see myself, when Christ sees me, I only want Christ on me, nothing else. I want everything else the world ever laid on me, anything else I ever want to grab a hold of, set aside. I only want Christ. Now, he makes the comment that all of you who have been baptized into Christ have been clothed with Christ. Now, let me make this clear. Baptism is a real act. It's really something you do. Baptism really is something done in water, but he isn't talking about water here. This has less to do with water and more to do with death. There have been many people through the years that we have taken to a baptistry, and they have gone in the changing room, taken off their old clothes, put on new robes, so to speak, gone in the baptistry, gotten out of the baptistry, went back to the room, and so to speak, put their old clothes on and went back home. Baptism doesn't do anything if there's not a death. His point is not about the act of baptism, although that is in there. His point is, you died. And when you died, you were clothed with Christ. I need to park here for a little bit. The Christian life is not for everyone. It's not. It's available for anyone, but Jesus didn't make it easy. There was no discount passes, no half-off enrollment fee, no sense of why don't you all come as a group, just kind of, I got a bus rate. There's none of that. The Christian life, in fact, Jesus drove people away. Jesus said to certain individuals, you can't be my disciple because you're not willing to sell everything you have. Come follow me. You can't be my disciple if you're not willing to do that. He didn't change the ground rules when you or I came in. In Luke chapter 9, Jesus said, if anyone, in fact, you could even say to everyone, if anyone would come after me, he must deny himself and take up his cross daily and follow me. That's basically a buzz phrase that means this. Unless you die to yourself, you can't be my disciple. Whoever wants to save or hold on to his life, so to speak, he's going to lose it. But whoever loses his life, surrenders it, gives it away, gives it to me, he'll save it. The Lord is not asking for partial on anything. Anybody who says you can have part of me, here's some of me, here's days you can have of me, portions you can have of me, you can be sure is not a Christian. Is not a Christian. Christian people are fully surrendered people. It's not my words, it's biblical words. Fully surrendered people. Some of the Bible words that used to talk about these fully surrendered people is the word faith. That means putting my whole trust in Him and none of my trust anywhere else. It means putting my love in Him. I love Christ. I love the Lord, but I don't love my own life. It means death. Death to myself that I might live to Him. The Christian is the one who says, I am yours, I completely surrender. Now here's the kicker. That's all. That's everything. That's it. The Christian is the one who says, I'm yours. And there's nothing else to be said. It is not that I am yours and I belong to you, but I'm going to be sure and attend on Sundays. No, that's not right at all. It's not I'm yours, I'm completely yours, and I'm going to be sure that I don't drink. No, that's not it at all. I'm yours, I'm completely yours, but I have to be sure that I give enough financially. No, that's not it either. I'm yours, and I got to be sure and change my language. No. It's not I'm yours and anything else. It's not even about praying daily or worshiping weekly or any other law that would earn me status or earn me demerits. It's not about weights and scales, where the things I do for Christ are put on this side of the scales and the things that I do that are not right and sin are on this side of the scales and God kinds of weighs them. It is none of those things. It's not about how much or how often or how far my following goes. It is about God reading the desire of my heart and nothing else. And does He find faith? Does He find in the very nooks and crannies of my life, I have died to me and I live to Him? If that be the case, I am His. And if I have not, I am not. That is as simple as the New Testament gospel is. There is nothing else. It's not about Sundays. It's not about communion. It's not even about a water baptism. It's not about tons of things. It is there a heart that belongs to Christ? No partial qualifiers. No sort of exchanges. No compromise, no negotiation, no mediation. And if it is about belonging to Christ, nothing else is needed. Nothing else is needed. That means that wonder of wonders, He has chosen to save simply those who desire Him. Those who with the core of their heart and life and mind desire Him, He has chosen to save. That means that the most godly elder of the most godly church who served 50 years in saintly ways is every bit as precious to God as the prisoner over here in the Jasper County Jail who's a 15-minute repentant man and he's in cell number 3. Because in the nook and cranny of the heart, God said, both desire me. Welcome home, child. That means that the lifelong missionary and the tired mama in row number 6 are just as loved and just as embraced by Christ and just as indwelt by Him. Because all He is looking for is not the law-keeping, the rule-keeping, the bonuses, the merits. All of that is nonsense. All He's looking for is there faith in that heart? A sold-out, genuine faith. As does status with God. Compare me to any 14-year-old boy out in this audience. I've gained no advantage from this pulpit. I've gained no advantage through all the years of offerings. I've gained no advantage through years of counseling with folks or Bible studies. I've gained no advantage over him in any way, shape, or form. God will judge me and that 14-year-old boy on the same basis. Do you love me? Have you put your trust in me? If you have, that's enough. If you haven't, that pulpit won't make a bit of difference. Nothing will change. The fact that the Christian gospel is only about whether I have surrendered my life to Christ and has nothing to do with achievements and nothing to do with laws, and nothing to do with I's I've dotted and T's I've crossed, is a scary thing to lots of folks. When I'm saying this, I almost know, because I had it in my own mind in past years, you can almost hear panic setting in on somebody. And the fence builders start showing up going, wait a second, backing the pickup truck up and unloading fence and wire and bar, you know, I mean, everything going, wait a second, this is, no, you've gone far too far. Galatians 5, verse 1, listen to what Paul says. It is for freedom that Christ has set us free. Stand firm and do not let yourself be burdened again by a yoke of slavery. You say, what's that mean? For 2 straight chapters, all he has done is every time he's mentioned slavery or yoke or any of those words, it has always been about any law keeping, any law keeping, any rule keeping, any set of minimum standards you're trying to reach or attain. It's always defined as slavery. He becomes so angry that over in verse 12, this is not language you normally use in mixed company. But he says, I want you to know if those who think that circumcision or anything else earns some kind of merit in the sight of God, then go ahead and castrate yourself and see what that will do. It will gain you nothing either. I mean, Paul, did you not know women would be reading this thing? Did you not know kids would hear? Paul, what are you doing? And the answer is, I am telling you, there are no laws, there are no acts, there are nothing you can do that would so impress God that he would want to save you. The only thing it is in your heart and in your mind, have you died to you that you might live for Christ? If you have, you need nothing else. And if you haven't, nothing else will do. It's very important that we understand that it's not that those folks were building the wrong fences. I think I approached that for a long time in my own mind. The problem was they were building the wrong fences. They were sort of using the Old Testament to build their fence when they should have been using New Testament fences. This is not a debate about which laws we're free from. Hear me. This is not about which laws we're free from. The scary news is we are free from laws. We will not be judged on the basis of laws at all. One of my favorite cartoons, I saw it years and years and years ago. I probably said the last hour 50 years ago. It was 40 years ago I saw it. Been redone. I've seen it a time or two. It's still pretty cute every time you see the silly thing. And you have to know it from a certain background that I came from, maybe for it to be as humorous to you as it is to me. But there's heaven and this long line on the judgment line waiting for their time of judgment at heaven's gates. And this long line, and you can see off in the distance up toward the front gate, there are people just whooping and hollering and doing handsprings and, you know, shouting and so joyful up the front. And people at the back of the line are trying to figure out what in the world's going on up there. So they find one old state elder. I mean, this guy hadn't smiled in 30 years. I mean, this guy's serious. And I mean, this guy, and they send him up to go find out what's going on up there. And this old elder goes up the front and he gets the front of the line. And next thing you know, they see him. The guy's doing handsprings and, you know, cartwheels and running back and running back. And when he gets close enough, they can hear him. He's shouting, Wednesday nights don't count. Wednesday nights don't count. Wednesday nights don't count. And Sunday mornings don't either. Did you hear me? And Sunday mornings don't either. And communion services didn't. And mission trips didn't. And going to Bible college didn't. And tithing didn't. It didn't count. When God judged me, he didn't discuss any of those. When God looked at me, he didn't see me through the lens of any of those. Wednesday nights don't count. The basic biblical principle is God judges on the inside, not on the outside. Love and faith are things God either sees in the heart or he doesn't. It's either real and genuine, and he knows it, or it's not. On the outside, laws are anything we do outwardly, anything we clothe ourselves in. But the outside doesn't matter if the inside is not this. And if the inside is this, then the outside is irrelevant. I apologize for the following illustration, but they don't get any better than this. I'm sorry. It's just what I got. I thought about that a long time. I kicked this thing around, and maybe this will help. Anything we do outwardly is extremely irrelevant in this sense. You could put pearl earrings and a pearl necklace on a pig. And I guess it would snazz the pig up a little, but it's still a pig. And the earrings and the necklace are still pretty irrelevant. It's still a pig. You could put makeup on a baby. You could put makeup on a baby. We don't need to. The baby's sweet enough and precious enough and gorgeous enough without the makeup. It's irrelevant. Ultimately, it goes this. Everything I put on me, I'm either the pig and it's irrelevant. It doesn't change anything. Or in the sight of God, I'm already that baby he loves and is accepted and is precious in his sight, and it's irrelevant. But either way, I don't need it. Either way, it is my heart. My heart either is His or it's not. If it is His, don't waste the makeup. If it's not, don't waste the makeup. But God, You're the one who gave laws. Yes, yes, He did. And this is important to understand. He uses the analogy in chapter 3 and then part of chapter 4. He says, yes, God gave laws at one time, but it's the difference between when you were under guardianship and when you're in sonship. He said, let me talk about those. Guardianship, you had laws. Sonship, you don't. Back in that culture, most every wealthy Greek or Roman family, when they had children born, they nearly always went out and bought a slave they put in charge of that child. Well, we tend to think of the child being in charge, but it really wasn't. So what they would do is they would bring in this slave, and the head of the household would say, now I've got a son who's now two or three or whatever, and you're, I mean, he's your charge. And I want you to know your head's going to rule if anything ever happens to that boy. I want you to know that boy needs to be protected and that boy needs raised. And I will expect you to make him mind. I will expect you to raise him in right ways. And I'm going to hold you accountable. So when that little three-year-old boy went in the backyard, that slave went out there and that slave picks him up. Anytime the little boy gets his fingers close to something he could hurt himself with. Because why? Because my head's on the line if the little boy gets hurt. And this slave is protecting that boy, pulling him out of all kinds of situations. When the little boy is ornery and hurting someone, that slave is the one blistering his bottom. Because if this kid turns out to be a spoiled brat, that master is going to cut my head off. And so the slave holds the little boy accountable. The slave in the mornings would take the six-year-old boy to school, and then the slave very likely sat in the back of the classroom to watch, and if he didn't do his homework, I'm going to give him what for on the way home, because I'm responsible to see this boy's raised right. So this slave raises the boy for all practical purposes. But there comes a day where the son is now grown. And the father calls the son in and basically says to him, look, I've had you under a guardianship and I made you behave in right ways for this family, but just old enough now, you either have a heart like your father and you have this family's heart or you don't. If you don't, the slave can't make you have it. And if you do, I don't need the slave anymore. The slave is released. You are now free to live as my son. Well, you say, but God had rules. Yeah, He did when you were six, and when you were four, and when you were eight, for lack of a better term. But now in Christ, you don't need that. You either love the Lord and follow Him or you don't. You're released. That's why He says it's guardianship or sonship. Now, in all fairness, we don't always like freedom. We don't always like the freedom that sonship sort of brings. My kids have hated it at many times, freedom. Megan happened to be in the first service. By the way, welcome, Miss Mary. Good to see you, sweetheart. One of our great miracle babies sitting over here. I'll tell you what, I cannot tell you how pleased I am of the grace of God in your family. And Mary's been ill since this baby was born, but I am so glad for you guys. Megan was sitting over here, but this morning I was using the illustration that with my kids, there were certainly times in my life, in the lives of my kids, where I said, I want you to do X, Y, Z, and I gave them pretty specific instructions. I mean, they knew that. They were little kids growing up. But then they hit the stage where they would say, what do you want me to do, Dad? And I would say, well, I want you to do whatever you think's right. Oh, don't. I hate that, Dad. Don't do that. No, tell me what you really want. Don't tell us to do everything's right. Well, why do they feel that way? The answer is pretty simple. Doing X, Y, Z, they can detach themselves from whatever it is and just do whatever it is. But if I say, I want you to do whatever's right, they have to get to the core of the matter. What does our family believe? What do I think? What do they think? What's right? And they have to wrestle through with the big issue. It's a whole lot easier to be told X, Y, Z. You could do it on autopilot, turn your mind off. You can't simply serve out of your heart, turn your mind off. I don't know if this illustration is helpful for this sermon, but I want to tell the illustration anyhow. Preachers do that a lot, you know. People don't like freedom. Julie and I got so tickled. We flew out to Arizona on July the 4th. Rates were cheaper that day, so we flew, quite frankly. And so we have the 5th free, and then the 6th, the North American Christian Convention starts. So we go to the Grand Canyon. We need to get us one of those. Those are... I'm willing to trade them our chat piles even up. I mean, just straight even up. Man, it is something. I tell you, I don't care how much you've seen it in books. I loved it. Julie did too. It's gorgeous. I mean, it'll take your breath away. It is something. And you stand there, and the word that you can't help but think of is majestic and free and all kinds of words that come to your mind. Instead, you're standing there looking over the canyon. Julie and I took a hike along the top. We went a ways. We didn't go down. Wasn't time to do that. But we went along the deal. And off to the side, you have the canyon, and you'd stop and look. And they don't have guardrails and all that kind of stuff over here on this side, most of it. You can just stand where you want to look. We came across the lady, and I don't want to figure out all the psychology of it. There's some interesting things. On one hand, I can really appreciate some things, but there's a lady who never saw the Grand Canyon. Now, she was on the same trail with us. You need to know the canyons over here, they have a safe asphalt trail you can walk on here. This lady wasn't even walking on the asphalt. She was on the other side of the asphalt, and she didn't take a step that she didn't take a hold of a limb or a branch or a leaf, and she had her head turned. And she's just walking along this trail with her back turned, because to actually see the Grand Canyon was terrifying to her. She didn't want it. She wanted guardrails. She wanted support. Give me security. Lady, you'd have to fall and roll 12 times up that hill to get over that. But I've got a hold of this, you know. You see in the church, I think an awful lot of people who don't know how to stand at the majestic brink of the love of God and simply say, here am I, you can have all of me. They're going, no, what tree do I take a hold of? Tell me what step to do next. Give me, I don't want to see all of that. Give me rules. Martin Luther was teaching this to his students. And one of his students said, then you can do whatever you want, is what you're saying. Martin Luther replied, yes, do whatever you want. And then after his pause, he said, now, what do you want? Ah, that's the crux. Do whatever you want. Now, what do you want? And my freedom gives me room to follow Christ, or gives me room to hang myself. What do I want? Chapter 5 pulls us all together. I need to quit. They're counting me down back there. I'm pretty sure they are. If not, you should have been. I like to have something to ignore. Chapter 5 starts pulling it all together. Next week, Kevin Klein and I are both preaching, and we'll pick this one up. But I have to at least logically take you one more step, and then we'll get out of this. If there are no rules, and they're not, there are none. Hear me, there are none. If there are no rules, then what do I do? How do I know what to do? How do I make any decision? His answer is, follow where the Spirit of Christ will lead you. Now, that's a whole subject we're going to spend next week on. The Spirit of Christ is not given to rule keepers. He gives the Spirit of Christ to those who love Him. Follow where the Spirit leads you. Oh, that's really helpful, Randy. That doesn't tell me much. Actually, it does. It tells you tons. He will mention, and he will probably, there's a threefold test for where the Spirit's leading you. That threefold test is easy. That threefold test for everything you do, everything you think, everything that's a part of your life, the threefold test is this. Can I take this as worship and lay it at Jesus' feet? God has a nature and a character. Can I take whatever I'm thinking, whatever I'm saying, whatever I'm doing, can I take as an act of worship and lay it at His feet? Is it compatible with His nature and character? As a quick illustration, I could not take my pornography and, so to say, make my act of worship and somehow, no, it doesn't meet Christ. Good grief, no, that didn't fit that test. Spirit would never lead me there. Spirit would lead me what? in areas that are more about adoration of a creator and having the heart and so forth and so forth. No, the Spirit's never going to take me into things that are contrary to the heart of Christ. If all of my life is an act of worship, I have to evaluate everything. How does this suit God's nature for worship? The second test, will this make me more like Him? Will this make me more like Him? If it doesn't make me more like Him, then I don't need the old me resurrected. I need to be out of that. And I need to be doing these kinds of things. Not because there's a rule against it, but because my heart would be in violation of my heart's desire if I did it. Don't need a rule. Number three, will this strengthen other people around me? On the basis of those three things, I can evaluate most everything in the Spirit's leading. I'm here on Sunday morning not because I've got to do Sundays because somehow the rule book says so. I'm here on Sundays because I evaluate, is this something that I can lay at the feet of Christ as an act of worship? Yeah. Doesn't send me to heaven any quicker or to hell any further if I didn't do it. I mean, no. But it is something I can lay as an act of worship. Number two, would it cause me to be more like Him? Yeah, being around you, being around godly people, being around the Scriptures, being around the praise, yeah, it makes me more like Him. Yeah, I want to be here. Number three, does it strengthen others? Yeah, I hope so. I want to. Yeah. I don't drink anything, alcohol. There's no rule against drinking alcohol. I am free to drink alcohol. If I took a drink of alcohol, I'd be no quicker sent to hell, and I'd be no further back in the line for heaven. A drink of alcohol would not change anything. I am free. There are no fences. But I don't drink any. For one, I can't figure out how to lay it out as an act of worship. It's a whole industry built around self, quite frankly. You just watch. Watch how everything is advertised. Watch how everything is bundled. You take a look at everything related to alcohol, the whole industry, it is related around that concept. As an 18, 19, 20-year-old kid, even watching guys now in the power plays and all the kind of stuff, alcohol, I'm going, you know what? That didn't fit as an act of worship. And even if I thought it did fit or was more neutral, for lack of a better term, will it cause me to be more like Him? Well, the answer is no. To be more dependent upon things of the world? No. Five times this week, someone has walked up to me and said, Randy, I'm struggling with alcohol. I'm a Christian and I love Christ and I'm struggling with alcohol. It helps me unwind. It helps me loosen up. It helps me handle. The world will never give real answers. It doesn't give freedom. What you first got to free you pretty soon holds you. 7 out of 10 people have drinking problems before in this world before their life's over. Why don't we do that? Number three, will it strengthen other people? No, I don't want to bruise you in any way. So I choose not to drink. Because I have to? Would I be condemned if I didn't? Nah, not at all. But I can't see the Spirit of Christ lead me that direction. Now, I know from 1 Corinthians 8 that two brothers can do opposite things. One more mature, one less mature, and God be pleased by both. I understand. So I'm going to make decisions on some things you might not make. But maturity and time will bear out which one the Spirit was kind of really leading on. Ultimately, all of this basically comes down to in Galatians 5. Those who follow rules will find it powerless. Those who follow rules will have no fruit. And those who follow the Spirit of Christ will have the fruit of the Spirit. I've been in many, many homes where I've been fooled by the fruit. I mean that literally. I picked up the apple and it wasn't an apple. It was plastic or wax and I was sure that was an apple. It sure looked like an apple. I've been in many a home where I say, man, that looks gorgeous. How'd you get that plant to grow? Well, we got it off the third shelf at Walmart. It's at the plastic department. You know, there's a lot of plastic. You'll only have a plastic Christian life with no power or substance if you're a rule keeper. God literally gives His Spirit, and people who just love Him. And the fruit of your life will you have love and joy and peace and patience and kindness and goodness. So now which one do you want to be? Jewelry on a pig won't make any difference. And makeup on a baby is unnecessary. It's my heart, Lord.